Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. On the cover of John Hodgman's new book called Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms, there are illustrations. There's a plane, hence the title, the frequent flyer medallion status. But there's also pictures of what looks like a collegiate building, and there are two corgis. All of these images have something to do with Hodgman's negotiation of access and fame, or in some cases being fame adjacent. These are stories from, quote, Workland, as he explains, in contrast to his last book, the critically acclaimed Vacationland. In this book, Hodgman writes about his Daily Show days as the resident deranged billionaire, his unease with being repeatedly cast as the mustachioed creeper, and really how nice Paul Rudd is. The secret rooms in the title are sometimes metaphorical, sometimes literal. They include the Sky Lounge at his favorite airport, a secret society at his alma mater, Yale, a very welcoming hotel in California, the backstage at the Emmys, and simply fame itself. Now, John Hodgman claims to be not so famous in the book, but he's still doing well enough to go on book tour, as well as keep up his New York Times Magazine advice column, Judge John Hodgman, and the podcast of the same name. He maintains a Twitter account with more than a million followers where he tweeted, where you tweeted, you're sitting in front of me, talking about you like you're not here.
Yes, no, I'm here.
Where you tweeted yesterday, quote, sick day before pub date, don't worry about me, I have good socks on, and I'm rolling on that sweet Canadian full-grade Sudafed. Tomorrow, John Hodgman will be with Elizabeth Gilbert at Symphony Space, but he's here with us today on pub day. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling great, thank you very much. This is very, first of all, I can't feel better. I just passed Isabelle Huppert in the hallway. She was talking on French on her phone. I just want to go home. Like, it's done. This is the perfect day. Allison, I'm here. This is extremely surreal. I listen to you every day.
Oh, thanks.
I feel like I should be at my desk answering email right now because as I hear the theme song come on.
Okay.
It's very, very Pavlovian. So thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I enjoyed your book. I was trying to figure out how to get into it because there's a lot of different things we could talk about.
Sure.
But I want to talk about the writing.
Oh, the dogs. I thought we were going to talk about corgis. That's what everyone wants to talk about.
We always talk corgis. No, this is public radio. As you know, we're going to talk process for a minute.
Okay. I sat down and wrote it. That's pretty much what happened.
Back in the day, you used to make up these fanciful stories and fanciful characters.
Yes.
But this is really about you and your life and your family and how you live your life. Was that a conscious change you decided to make? Like, I'm going to go from the made up to the real thing.
It was not a conscious choice. It was just I ran out of material. I had been writing books of fake facts. My first three books were all books of fake trivia. So instead of a list of the nine U.S. presidents who smoked cigars, it was the nine U.S. presidents who secretly had hooks for hands. And I would make up stories about them. And that got me onto The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where I did more fake facts. I appeared as the very deadpan resident expert and later deranged millionaire. But after a while, somehow coinciding maybe with the current administration, I realized everyone was doing fake facts now. And I couldn't make up a fake fact to save my life. And so I had to do something. And so I just started telling the truth of all things.
You do have, your creative streak comes out in how you describe places. You use euphemisms and sort of, you make us kind of figure out what you're talking about. You star in a TV show and the lead is called Leading Best Friend and you fly on your beloved airline.
Right. Well, the book is about what it's like to be a famous, very famous minor television personality. And all of the weird secret societies and first class lounges and exclusive parties and secret rooms that you get admitted to, even with the most minor of fames. And then what it feels like to be slowly kicked out of them one by one and find yourself grounded, no longer as famous as even the least famous corgi on Instagram. And so, if anyone who looks at me, you'll know that my on-camera career is implausible. I started as a writer. I got kidnapped by television. I went on the Apple ads and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and had this extremely strange, almost 10-year period of being somewhat famous on television. I always felt a bit as a tourist and a little self-conscious about it. So when I talk in the book about the different places and people that I meet, I don't want to feel like I'm name-dropping. I'm just trying to talk about my strange experience being an outsider in this insider world.
I had about 15 months.
I don't name the airline
till the end.
I name the airline in the end, but I don't name the airline whose frequent flyer program I become obsessed with as my fame dwindles because they're not giving me any money.
Oh.
If Delta wanted to co-brand it, that would be fine.
But there is this thing. I had this period of for about 15 months of being very, very small F famous during the MTV years.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, I related to it because you get right up next to it.
You're right
like
up
you
next
nestle
to it.
Right up
mm-hmm.
next to it.
You know.
But you're only next to it.
Yeah, it's a strange.
Because Julia Roberts is over there.
Yeah, I know. Julia Roberts, I think she's really famous, right?
Super
I've heard.
Famous.
Yeah.
Super famous.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, I talk about in the book how Paul Rudd, who's a friend and an acquaintance and cameos in a lot of my audiobooks, he's a very sweet guy. Everyone loves Paul Rudd, right? I'm not saying anything that people don't know. But he invited me to be part of a fundraiser for Children's Hospital in Kansas City, where he's from. And he invited all of his famous friends and me. And we did a lot of fun stuff down there. We had a bowling tournament. We raised a lot of money. We had a concert. But the important thing is to go visit the sick kids mm-hmm. in the hospital. And it's very humbling. You're seeing families dealing with the worst possible thing. And there's no better and more humbling way to realize just how unfamous you are than to stare down a family of a sick child. And they're like, where's Paul Rudd? Who are you? Why are you here? I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Do you guys not familiar with my 3-episode arc on Red Oaks on Amazon? It's very, very upsetting to them. And I felt like I was doing more harm than good. But you know who the most famous person in the world is who was there, of course, was Weird Al Yankovic. Weird Al Yankovic walks in a room and it's like children, parents, grandparents all beam and smile and everyone gets immediately well. I mean, that's where you realize, oh, that's the real deal.
My guest is John Hodgman. The name of his new book is Medallion Status. You write about staying at a certain hotel in Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's exclusive. It's
a fancy pants hotel.
Chateau Marmont.
I mean, I'm not trying to be coy about it.
Okay.
I don't want to be, you know, outside of the book, I'll brag all the time. Inside the book, I just wanted to be a little bit cool about it.
Well, I want to read a little bit of how you write about it.
Stay there anymore. Go on.
The hotel, capital H, was a very fancy historic Hollywood hotel that looks like a French castle. The stipend, where they were giving you money to stay,
right,
did not even come close to covering the cost of the hotel. But I had stayed there during fancier times in my career, and I loved it. The first time I ever walked into the lobby, before I even checked in, the woman at the host stand said my favorite words, "It's John Hodgman." Later, I would ask the manager of the hotel if the woman at the host stand had been coached to say those words. He said no. He thought she was just a fan. This was a lie that I accepted for many years. And through this bond, the manager of the hotel and I gradually became friends. His name is Phil.
That's true. I named him Phil. Thank you. That was that was the very first time I stayed at the hotel. It was during the time when I was doing the Apple ads. And that was the fanciest time in my career.
Mm.
And it was one of the first times that someone had said, or a random person said, it's John Hodgman. I was on The Daily Show at that time. But I do feel like they do a good job there making you feel super special. But being seen in that way is really, really sort of unnerving and transformative and powerful, because most people aren't seen in real life, even by their own families. Most people don't get seen. And so to have strangers coming up to you and say, it's you, it's John Hodgman, or for that matter, for an airline, once you hit gold medallion status, to say, thank you for being gold. It's like, I shuddered when I heard that. That was incredible. So it's a gift, you know.
Some people, though, for some people, fame is like a drug.
Oh, I think
they need to mainline it. They do anything to get it.
Yeah. Well, it's constant affirmation, and most people don't get that, and it's not healthy to only get affirmation, to only be told you're great. And obviously, it warps lives, you know. And I think the only people who feel comfortable with any sort of fame, especially visual fame when you're on TV and people can see you and they're like, you're a weird TV ghost who's in my world right now. The only people who feel comfortable with that are sociopaths. And then what fame does is it gradually turns you into a sociopath. And then finally you think you deserve it. And that's when it tends to go away.
At what point did you realize, not that you were a sociopath, but that...
No, I'm not a sociopath.
Not at all.
No sociopath would ever say that he was a sociopath.
Were you, you would think,
mm-hmm.
Did you realize that that the fame machine was really starting to bum you out?
Oh, it never bummed me out.
You never got bummed out by it?
No, it's fantastic. I'm sorry. There's a lot of free snacks involved. It's obviously, and you know, obviously it put me into worlds and into conversations that I never thought that I could ever have. I mean, staying at a fancy hotel is one thing, but you know, being able to meet and talk to heroes. I mean, I was always a fan of film and television. So getting to, you know, meet Griffin Dunne, you know, one of my favorite actors of all time, and getting to hang out with him and get to know him a little bit, and getting to work on sets with incredibly talented people. And, you know, acting is an incredible, fun, weird, challenging thing to do. And Judy Greer is amazing. I mean, it's all fun. It's all fun, you know. I don't think that it ever became a drag. It was a drag to travel and leave my family behind. But as you'll read in the book, I was willing to do it. You know, luckily, when the TV show that I was on, where I played the leading character's third best friend, not best friend, not second best friend, I was like the speaker of the house of best friendship. When that was canceled, I did meet it with a mix of sadness and relief. Probably the same mix of sadness and relief I would have felt if it had been renewed, because that was a time when my kids were getting older and they actually noticed that I wasn't around.
You in the book give advice to various age people. You return to Yale, to your alma mater.
Yes.
And there's a home of the secret society.
Yes.
And even as an adult, there's a moment when you want in.
Yeah, of
you
course.
You want to get in. Peek into the secret society.
Well, I mean, you know... People don't know, Yale is populated with a number of senior secret societies that have go back 100 years or so. Skull and Bones is the most famous one. And they occupy these big historic buildings in New Haven that have no windows. They're these clubhouses that were built by the Vanderbilt's architect for children to hang around in. So it's a very weird thing that I was very fascinated with. And when I was a student there, I got invited to a party. And I got so excited that I got drunk and fell down the stairs. And when I woke up, I had no memory of ever being inside this particular, they call them tombs. So I became haunted by the fact that my body had gone into the world and seen and experienced things that I could not remember, because secret societies can keep their secrets. So then when I got, I mean, this is the thing, when you have a little bit of renown, people might say, hey, come have a party at the secret society as an adult. And I got to go back in there. And I gave the kids some advice, which is, don't get drunk and fall down the stairs. You're not immortal. Please.
You also gave them good advice about not being afraid to say yes to things.
Right.
That yes is yes.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah. I mean, I had gotten very close to a terrible thing in my life, which was when the Apple ads were initially offered to me, I said no, because I didn't want to disrupt my life. I had two little children. I had to pick up my daughter at preschool the day they wanted me to fly out to audition for a third time. And I said, this is not realistic. I'm not supposed to be on television. Everyone knows this. Let's stop this farce right now. And then I'm very lucky that they said, well, what if we just offer you the job? And at that point, I knew I had to say yes. Because if it doesn't hurt you or other people, it's good to say yes in life. If someone invites you to do something interesting, even if it's scary, say yes.
So after the chapter of giving advice to smarty pants people up at Yale.
Yeah.
You have a chapter, career advice for children.
Career advice I think it's very important. I have a strong audience and a consistent audience of strange 13-year-old people, young people. They always show up my readings with their very patient parents and guardians. I've seen them as they've grown up over the years. I think they sense in me that I was also a strange, lonely, weird 13-year-old. But in fact, I'm almost 50 and I've got a lot of experience, and I want to tell them what they should do in terms of getting jobs. They got to start thinking about getting jobs in this world.
You talk about your time at a cheese shop.
Yep. The cheese shop. When I worked at a cheese shop and I played Tom Waits, and a woman said to me, who is this? Tom Waits is my favorite musician. I said, who is this playing? Who's this on the stereo? I'm like, oh, it's Tom Waits. Are you interested? She said, no, I just want to make sure I know what it is so I never accidentally buy it. It was such a mean thing to say.
So mean.
But the lesson is, your job is not your chance to curate culture for other people. You don't put on songs in the coffee shop in order to educate people. You're there just to serve the coffee and sell the cheese.
Yours is a video store clerk. Rest in peace, video stores.
Well, yeah, that one was really, because that was something I could have done for the rest of my life. Working in the video store was the greatest, short of working in a movie theater. But, you know, because you would just watch movies all day with your friends. And it gets very easy. And I thought, maybe I'll just do this for the rest of my life. But you don't want to get comfortable in those easy jobs. You want hard, challenging jobs. Because if you get stuck in the easy jobs, maybe someone will invent Netflix. And then you're done.
My guest is John Hodgman. The name of his book is Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms. This has stuck with me. You write in the book, there is no television anymore, but also there is only television.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Early in the book, I say, you know, I'd say I'm not really on television that much anymore, but that doesn't matter because neither is television. Because, of course, we live in an age where there is so much streaming content, so much television, so, you know, almost all of culture now. You know, going into the Emmys, I'm a member of the Television Academy, and ridiculously, I get sent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of DVDs of whole seasons of television packaged in these incredibly ornate cardboard boxes. It's this incredible monument to waste. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just it's a monument to waste, of course, because all this stuff is streaming anyway. Our culture is totally bifurcated or, you know, multifurcated over all these different platforms. And yet here there's more television than you can ever hope to ever watch in your life. And I feel like sometimes it just feels like all there is like, did you watch this last night? Have you watched this last night? Did you watch Fleabag yet? Have you watched Fleabag?
I have, but it took me a while to get around to it.
I know, me too. I felt like such a dummy for so long, and it's the greatest.
I know. I've been pumping Succession. That's the one.
I know. See, this is what happens. It overtakes every conversation. Like Succession, I feel like Succession took over my whole realm of social media about 5 weeks ago. All of a sudden, that's all people talk about, and I feel out of it. So it's great.
Although it is nice to talk about something else than politics for a minute.
Well, I think that that's
part of it.
I think that that's part of it. I mean, I think that we need engagement all the time, but we also need distraction all the time. And story has always been important. People think, you know, story should be politically engaged, and that's true. Mm-hmm. But we would tell stories around fires in order to ignore the darkness at our backs. And sometimes we just need distraction in order to survive.
John, our staff was really excited you were coming on the show.
Thank you, staff.
And they really wanted to ask you some questions.
Sure.
Some Judge John Hodgman questions. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, this is
one. You're going to read the questions to me.
Here you go.
Because I don't want to see the staff. No, thank
staff?
You.
Staff?
Sorry, staff.
I've been talking about fame for 5 minutes. You think I'm going to see a staff?
Yeah.
Okay. Office supplies are hard to come by on our show.
Mm-hmm.
We all use Post-it notes, but it often falls on the shoulders of one person on our team to restock our Post-it supply and share with everyone. We go through these notes quickly. Should we each purchase our own supply of Post-it notes? Should we take turns buying them and sharing? Or should we put in a request for office supplies for the company, which provides them now and then, but unfortunately, they don't supply us with the brand notes, but the inferior no-name ones that fall off? If you think I'm kidding about how hard it is to come with office supplies,
I've been trying to get tape for a week. I'm looking at an empty tape dispenser. First of all, staff, give up on the hope that public radio is going to buy you any Post-it notes. Come on. You should all get your own Post-it notes, and you should each have your own color. And then you're going to have fun because you'll know who to blame for each Post-it note.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Yeah.
This is another one from someone.
I choose magenta.
Someone else on my staff. I share a bathroom with two roommates. There's frequently hair left in the drain. Ooh. I know who it's coming from because only one of us has long hair. Do I confront that person directly about it or keep sending group text reminders to keep the drain clear?
Look, I am an only child. That means I'm a member of the super smart, afraid of conflict narcissist club. Very afraid. I had no rehearsal of conflict in my life. I had no siblings to fight with. Confrontation makes me very nervous. That whole topic just made me very nervous. But it is important to just be able to go up to someone and say, I have the problem with your dumb hairs. Get them out of the drain.
And finally, I believe that if you're visiting friends and staying with them for 4 days or fewer, you should not be expected to buy your own shampoo, conditioner, or body wash and can just use theirs. Bars of soap are the exception. The rest of the office says this is not okay and I should bring my own stuff. And also, I should not be staying with friends for 4 days straight. Am I wrong?
I don't want to know which member of the staff is because that person's a deadbeat and I don't want them near me. I'm afraid they're going to invade my home and take all my shampoos. Yeah, you know, if you're being a guest at someone's house, you should help them out as much as possible and buy groceries, get your own shampoo, just be easy on them.
You give good advice.
Yeah, well, I'm very old.
As well.
Thank you.
Me as well.
No.
Before I let you go, we got a minute, the serious question. When you're writing this book, who did you think it could help, if anyone?
Well, you know, as I say in the book, we only have our own stories to tell. So I'm very lucky that I have a listenership of Judge John Hodgman, and a readership of the column and so forth, and the people who are interested in my life, so I can tell it to them. I hope that it's helpful to let people see me as. Mm-hmm. Basically, as nakedly, there's a whole story in the book about me doing a nude scene with an oboe on Mozart in the Jungle, and I explained, like, you know, it's best when we tell our truths as nakedly as possible, Because if you let other people see you, then they feel seen as well. And since, you know, it's a gift to me to be seen, even now, however rarely on the street and someone says it's John Hodgman, I really want people to be able to recognize in their own lives that they're famous too.
The name of the book is Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms. John Hodgman, so nice to have you in studio.
Thank you so much.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and I'll meet you at the top of the hour.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.